Greetings and salutations, my glorious subjects. It is I, Allison Dixon, your faithful Queen Ding Dong, here with another ditch episode, that short weekly proclamation of WTH you've come to know and love between regular seasons of Ding Dong Darkness Time. Unless you've been living in a cave, and even then I'm sure the news would have found its way to you by now, you probably know there's been a death in the family. The royal family, that is. So it seemed appropriate, in light of Queen Elizabeth II's passing, to give this week's show a bit of a monarchical twist. And I'm doing that in the only way I know how, by talking about incest. At the end of today's show, I'll have an announcement regarding the future of this podcast and what things will look like going forward. But for now, just sit back while I jaw a bit about the Habsburgs. See what I did there? If not, you will soon enough. Look, I'm just gonna say it. Royalty is a cultural skin tag we humans cannot seem to slough. From the earliest moments of recorded history, we have always arranged structural hierarchies in the pursuit of some wise person to guide us through a frightening and uncertain world. Somebody please tell me what to do with my life, am I right? And we all have a boss over our heads. Climb to the top of any organizational pyramid, and you'll find either God or gravity leering at you. But monarchies were built on something entirely different, that of divine right, which is to say that people believed that certain families literally had different blood than everyone else, blood blessed by God himself, which gave kings and queens and anyone else with that blood in their veins the authority to act as God, which made them exempt from most forms of questioning and accountability. Divine right theory actually deserves its whole episode to discuss in greater detail, especially in all the ways it clashed with the more ecclesiastical end of things, i.e. the church, and the way the ghosts of that belief linger to this very day. But for the purposes of this topic, I think it's enough to stick to the prevailing belief that royal blood was blessed. It also sets the proper ironic tone, because when it came to the Spanish Habsburg dynasty in particular, things couldn't have fallen further from the ideas of God and the divine if they'd landed in the middle of a pentagram during a satanic mass. The Habsburgs fully came to power in Spain in the year 1516, and as was often the case in those days, they took the throne by way of marriage. And that's probably obvious enough, because you've no doubt been saying to yourself, hey, doesn't Habsburg sound a little German? And you would be correct. The Habsburgs indeed are of German and Austrian stock, but the family had also been ruling over parts of Western Europe in what is now Germany, Austria, Belgium, France, and the Netherlands for a couple centuries already. And Philip I of Burgundy set his sights on Spain at the behest of his Holy Roman Emperor father, Maximilian I. He married the female heir to that throne, Joanna of Castile. She, by the way, was the daughter of the infamous king and queen, Ferdinand and Isabel. For those of you who were force-fed loads of Christopher Columbus propaganda from a young age, you might slightly recognize those names. Anyway, the whole saga of Philip and Joanna, including how Philip ended up sitting on the Spanish throne, is pretty tangled because neither of these kids were technically in line for the throne. In fact, they were third in line because they each had older siblings who were in line ahead of them, and those siblings were also married to one another. But both of those siblings died before they had kids. Then Queen Isabel kicked off, so in 1504, Joanna took the throne. Her father, who remained alive for a number of years after, attempted to maintain power, but unfortunately for him, everyone hated his guts. So Philip was then made king in 1506, And it was hard fought for him because he'd spent a lot of years abusing the hell out of Joanna to the point where everyone thought she was insane. Truthfully, she was what we'd now call clinically depressed, and given the people she was surrounded by, including a husband who regularly undermined, plotted against, and cheated on her to gain more power, and a father who was also a giant a-hole, no one could blame the woman. But then, only a few months after assuming the crown, Philip died. Some say of typhoid, others say assassination, leaving Joanna completely bereft. She was actually madly in love with Philip their entire marriage, despite everything he did to her. It's just a really sad story about her. Anyway, after about a decade on the throne, both Joanna's father and her son Charles conspired to have her locked away for the rest of her life, and she's known now in history as Joanna the Crazy, which seems more than a little tasteless, if you ask me. Anyway, her son Charles then became both the King of Spain and the Holy Roman Emperor, making him the most powerful monarch since Charlemagne, the man to whom all these very twisted bloodlines lead back. And that, my friends, is where the incest really began. And the incest is what you tuned in for, right? Not me blathering on about royal breeding charts. Besides, you already must know I'm skipping over so much history here. And let me be clear, inbreeding was already well underway with these folks before the union of Joanna and Philip. If you want to get into all the nooks and crannies, I'll have plenty of links for you in the show notes. So, what better way for a family of outsiders with quote-unquote divine blood to maintain control than to marry within one's own family? Furthermore, since the conquest of the Spanish throne, the Habsburgs ended up controlling nearly all of the influential courts in Europe, so they had no other strategic marriages to make in order to gain additional power, and I suppose just marrying outside the family wasn't, you know, hot to them, who knows. So they set about concentrating that power by marrying one another. At that point, I'm not sure how much was known about the health concerns of inbreeding. We're a couple centuries before the birth of the godfather of genetic science, Gregor Mendel, and his handy Punnett squares we all loved so much in high school biology class. But even if there was such knowledge at the time, there was enough royal hubris and lust for maintaining power flying around that the Habsburgs likely believed the rules just didn't apply to them. But it would eventually become quite clear that marrying first cousins, aunts, uncles, nieces, and nephews generation after generation was a very bad idea. Let's start with that famous Habsburg jaw I alluded to back in the intro. Charles I, the progeny of Joanna and Philip, had one hell of a prominent mandible. It was always a big Habsburg family trait. Even Marie Antoinette, herself the daughter of an Austrian Habsburg queen, had a touch of this passed down to her, though it only showed itself as a pouty little underbite. Could almost be thought of as kind of cute, you know, depending on the fashion of the time. Charles, on the other hand, let's just say he had a head that resembled something like the lower half of a crescent moon. Considering that all portraits of royalty were intended to be flattering, it's saying something that Charles still so obviously had this particular deformity. And thanks to all the generations of close inbreeding, that deformity passed down, becoming increasingly worse. Think of it like going fishing in an increasingly shrinking pond where a number of the fish have some kind of horrible mutation. The more you continue to take from that diminishing pond without adding in more water or more fish, the more likely you'll end up plucking out something that has two heads. In the case of the Habsburgs, it wasn't only the bad jaw. They also passed down pituitary hormone deficiencies that caused small stature, infertility and impotency, and major digestive issues. This was also compounded by an inherited disorder that caused a buildup of acid in the kidneys, resulting in bloody urine, weak muscles, and an enlarged head. Worse yet, all of the inbreeding was having a considerable effect on the family's ability to have babies that survived to adulthood. Only half of the children born to the Habsburgs, a royal frickin' family, mind you, a very rich and powerful group of people, survived past the age of 10. That's right. By comparison, the infant and child mortality rate for a Spanish commoner of the time was around 20%. It's just crazy to even think about. A 50% child and infant mortality rate in a royal family, and that's all due to the inbreeding. So this terrible legacy of forebears fell like a ton of bricks on the man who ended up being the final heir of the Spanish Habsburg dynasty, the product of 16 generations of close intermarriage, Charles II, the son of a man who'd married his niece. And, you know, it's even more tangled up the further back you go. This family tree was so messed up, his grandmother was also his aunt. I'm not even going to try to figure all that out, so I'll just leave it to you to worry out like a pile of badly knotted necklaces. Poor Charles II, now, he didn't ask for any of this, and he took the throne when he was only like 4 or 5 years old, so I feel nothing but awful for this guy. Here is a partial litany of his incest-related ailments. His lower jaw, which we already mentioned, jutted out so far, his teeth didn't come together well enough for him to chew his food. He reportedly swallowed his meals whole, which only increased his digestive issues. His tongue was also very swollen, making it very hard for him to speak. He had regular epileptic seizures. I mentioned this in my previous episode, the one on mummies and corpse medicine. Charles was the one who remedied this with the King's Drops developed from soaking a human skull in alcohol. He didn't actually speak until he was 4 years old and was unable to walk until he was 8. Mentally, though, he seemed to have it all together. It was just his body that was cursed, to the point he became known as the Bewitched King. Despite all his physical challenges, he was actually married twice. His first wife died relatively soon, but his second wife had several children from a previous marriage. However, she was never successfully impregnated by Charles, meaning he had no heirs of his own. This was particularly problematic when Charles died at the age of 39. Not only was it the end of this cursed bloodline, but all the political bickering and infighting over who should become king resulted in the War of Spanish Succession, which raged on for over a decade. But Charles II and the fate of the Spanish Habsburgs is only one example of rampant royal inbreeding. This stuff goes way back to ancient Egypt, where modern forensic imaging techniques revealed that young King Tut, who was a product of a union between his father and his father's sister, had a whole host of physical abnormalities commonly found in people who are the product of incestuous unions. He had an elongated skull, a cleft palate, club feet, and DNA testing later revealed a lot of incest in that bloodline. He only attempted to continue it, though, by also marrying his own sister. It was a bit of a custom in those days, actually. They had no surviving children. Zip forward to 19th century England, the reign of Queen Victoria, and you'll find evidence of more health issues caused by inbreeding. The Queen and her husband, who was also her first cousin, by the way, Prince Albert, both carried a recessive gene for the blood clotting disorder hemophilia. Their three children also carried this gene, and due to their various marriages that spanned between Russia and India, that hemophilia gene was passed all across Europe. It was, in fact, considered a royal disease. But it doesn't end quietly, because Victoria's granddaughter was Alexandra Romanov, the last Tsarina of Russia. Her son, Alexei, inherited the hemophilia, and he was so affected by the bleeding incidents that Alexandra sought the help of mythical mystic Rasputin. I probably don't have to take you much further down this road, and maybe I'm playing a bit of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with history here. After all, one could easily say the Romanovs were doomed regardless. But it's not too hard to draw a straight line between the custom of inbreeding and the eventual extinction of yet another royal family. At the very least, we can say it didn't help matters. Also, some speculate that because both Queen Victoria and Prince Albert both had this recessive gene as first cousins, it's likely that either or both of them were too the product of incest, which is no great surprise. There are countless more incidents of kings, queens, and emperors whose madness and other maladies could likely be tied to inbreeding, though some of it could also be laid at the feet of lead poisoning, which was rampant in ancient Rome in particular. It's a fascinating look at how every time a family has used this practice to consolidate power, it almost always led to bad health and shorter lifespans, all of which defeated the purpose. The recently departed Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip were third cousins, which is really not terribly egregious, especially by the standards I outlined above, and they both went on to live very long lives and produce multiple children. There have been some other areas of Queen Elizabeth's line that might have cases of incest, but the royals keep a tight lid on those things these days. Here in the United States, though, the culture around incest is quite different. While we have our own dynastic tendencies when it comes to families, Kennedys, Bushes, or Rockefellers, anyone, the practice of keeping it in the family is often associated with more, let's just say, isolated and rustic lifestyles, and it tends to take on a tone of going after people living in extreme poverty. One strong modern example of this is the Whitaker family from the town of Odd, West Virginia, whom an author and documentarian branded the world's most inbred family due to their very specific deformities. With their very poor living conditions and a strong local folklore that has had people visiting their house to harass them for many years, the whole thing just seems very sad all around. That said, their neighbors are extremely protective, and anyone who tries to get too close to the Whitaker place these days might end up with a shotgun pointed at them. And then there's the Blue Fugate family from Troublesome Creek, Kentucky. By the way, Troublesome Creek, I think, is the best town name I have ever heard of in my life. I want to see a whole Western series just devoted to the stories of Troublesome Creek. But anyway, these people were blue, and I mean literally blue-skinned. An orphan named Martin Fugate settled there in 1820, and he married a woman named Elizabeth Smith. Unbeknownst to them, they both carried a recessive gene that resulted in blue skin. Four of their seven children were born this way. And because they were so cut off from the rest of civilization, it would be decades before roads and a train line would make it to their neck of the woods. They had nowhere to turn to reproduce but to their own. The disorder was caused by the body producing too much methemoglobin, which is essentially red blood cells that have been deprived of oxygen due to the lack of a certain enzyme. It can cause a whole host of other problems in addition to the cyanosis, like shortness of breath, seizures, and heart problems. The disorder turns the blood a brownish color, which has the effect of making the skin appear blue. The phenomenon has been seen in other isolated clusters, such as the indigenous people of Alaska. A treatment was eventually developed that returned a rosy hue to the skin, and eventually the blue Fugates were able to enter a wider world without fear and find a much deeper gene pool. As recently as the 1970s, a descendant of the Fugates was born with blue skin, but he received treatment and has so far been the last one, as the recessive genes, thanks to a lack of isolation, were finally bred out. So, what can we glean from all this? Well, I think it's pretty self-evident, don't you? Don't have sex with your family members. It's not good, okay? The myth of pure blood is nothing but folly. And it's also racist as shit, but again, I'm positive I don't have to tell any of you that. I'll also add this. The people who did it due to extreme social and genetic isolation get more of a pass from me than a bunch of greedy rich a-holes who subjected countless future generations to a lifetime of pain and disability only so they wouldn't have to share their toys with outsiders. It certainly puts the animosity directed at Meghan Markle in perspective, doesn't it? The British royals aren't all that far removed from the mindset of their divine right ancestors. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed this game of genetic cat's cradle. As promised, before I wrapped up for the day, I wanted to announce that Season 3 Class of Cults has an actual premiere date of October 11th. It will begin with a primer episode featuring two of my favorite people, one you've met here numerous times, the other one is brand new to the show, and I hope he will be back for more. And I'm so excited about it, cannot wait to get this show on the road. And also, there's going to be a bit of a format change here. When I first envisioned Ding Dong Darkness Time, my hope was to have a steady stream of co-hosts. But as I've ventured into doing these solo episodes, as well as toiled through now two seasons of coordinating and juggling the schedules of everyone involved, I've decided to go way easier on myself and make this a mostly solo enterprise, with occasional guests mixed in to keep things lively, and quite frankly, to keep me from losing my mind out here by my lonesome in my recording cave week after week. The regular season episodes will still be longer form, with the short ditch episodes sprinkled in between, because I still want to keep bringing you those as well. I'm also working on getting this channel up on YouTube and possibly even setting up a Patreon that would open things up to bonus content. All of that will be a lot easier for me to engineer as a solo enterprise. It isn't that I don't want a regular co-host. It's also that, well, a lot of the people that I would like to have as co-hosts are busy with their own shows. So, you know, that kind of limits things. And also, I figured if I can't do it myself, then I guess I can't do it. So here's to the future solo enterprise. But that doesn't mean things can't change, and I could very well end up with a permanent exclusive co-host. Heck, it could even be one of you listening right now. I don't know. The important thing is keeping an open mind and appreciating the way this journey continues to evolve as it goes. No matter what, I just want you to know that I'm grateful for every one of you walking with me through this. If you wanted to do me an extra solid of spreading the word on your socials and dropping a review on Apple, I would freaking love that. And I'd love it even more if you dropped me a line at ddarknesstime@gmail.com or gave me a follow on Twitter or Instagram. As you do all that, I'll be hard at work teeing up more of the weird stuff, and I'll have a fresh episode ready for you next week. Until then, you know what to do. Be good, you little ding-dongs.